positive voltage, 0.69, I think it was. Where in the world did I do the absolute value? I first converted it to decibels, anyway. By 2, did that wrong. Anyhow, it was something like a 0.69 voltage reflection coefficient. You convert that to decibels by taking the log of it, multiply by 20, because it's a voltage, and you end up with 3.38 dB. So he confirmed that he had 1.69 dB of insertion loss of cable. You also take that voltage reflection coefficient, and you call it rho, that's what a voltage reflection coefficient is, when you convert it to an absolute magnitude. Standing wave ratio is equal to 1 plus rho over 1 minus rho, and you end up with a 5.2. So what Mel did is he measured a piece of cable by the fact that his AEA told him it's a 10 minus 10 is a very valuable piece of information. That told him electrical line length. It told him insertion loss. It told him he had a 5.2 VSWR. It told him he had a 1.69 dB reflection insertion loss, a 3.38 dB reflection coefficient. A lot of information came out of that simple sounding measurement once you know what the numbers all meant. Mel just plotted it for you on the Smith chart. I showed you a little bit about how to do it mathematically, which is the better way, whichever way works for you. And if you're a super smart guy, you do it both ways. You compare the answer and you say, hey, they come together, it seems reasonable. I've used two independent approaches, two independent techniques to come up with an answer. I've now got a level of confidence. I can tell the manufacturing department to go build that piece of hardware. That's the answer I expected to get. As opposed to what sometimes happens that Mel and I have seen, is you've got a guy fresh out of school who's real good at plugging numbers into a computer program because that's the way the school taught him. Let me drop a second, just in case the machine's got some kind of a timeout. Stand by a second. Okay. A guy comes fresh out of school having used a bunch of computer programs he was taught how to use. He doesn't know what approximate ballpark accurate figures would look like. He doesn't know how to do back-of-the-envelope calculations. He plugs numbers into an equation, into a computer program. He might plug Mel's numbers into a program and make some mathematical errors, and he might end up with a piece of coax cable that appears to have 2 dB of gain and a standing wave ratio of 1.05. Well, right away you know that when Mel gave you a resistive component of 10 ohms on a 50 ohm piece of cable, right away you know you're starting off with something like a 5-to-1 standing wave ratio. 10 ohms versus 50 ohms is a 5-to-1 ratio. So you know you're more than a 5-to-1 standing wave ratio. You plug those numbers into a computer program and you make some errors, and you come out with an answer of 1.05 VSWR. You know that's crazy. And if you come out with some number of dB of gain, you know that's crazy, because coax cable without an amplifier in the middle of it ain't got gain. So there's a number of checks and balances you should be using before you take the answer coming out of your computer program, you announce it to the manufacturing department, and say, yeah, go ahead and manufacture it. Now, with crazy numbers like that, you're going to have some egg on your face. They're eventually going to come back and say, you cost us a lot of money and a lot of man hours, and you gave us lousy answers. We're not sure you want you in the engineering department. So, a smart guy who's got some experience knows a little bit about what a reasonable-looking answer would look like. And if he's got two or three different ways of getting the answer, he's got much more confidence. And as such, particularly if he's got someone else, a more senior guy like Mel looking over his shoulder, saying, yes, you did it right, or no, I recommend you make this correction. And so that's the apprenticeship by which we learn wireless engineering. Unfortunately, none of the good schools seem to teach wireless engineering. You have to be working with the apprenticeship under the wing of somebody like Mel or myself for some amount of time. And if you stay friendly and you survive that apprenticeship program of some number of years, out comes a good wireless engineer. They don't come out of school. You have to hire a ham in general if you want a wireless engineer. That's an opinion. Back to you, Mel. K2KEY, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, I was going to expand a little bit more on this here, and that's why I more or less let you clarify some points. Basically, let's put it this way, another way I'm thinking, trying to keep this, as they say, you know, simply so that we don't put a lot of people to sleep or turn the knob on their radio to another meter. But basically, what's happening here, we determined, let's put it this way simply, that we determined approximately a 2 dB loss. This means that the RF energy from the generator or the transmitter or the signal generator, whatever you want to be calling it, is being attenuated by 2 points. Now, what Dick was alluding to, if you notice on the chart, they also have there a coefficient, the TRANSM period, coefficient T. That actually means our, it actually refers to the power ratio, one-way line attenuation. Now, simply put, let me break that down a little bit, what I just said. If we took 2 dB and we divide it by 10, we take the end, I should say, let me start again because I may be saying a little wrong. If we take the anti-log, remember a little bit of your math from school? If you took the anti-log, 0.0 dB, and divided it by 10, it will equal, Dick just figured out, 0.631. Now, that's basically based on what we call reflection coefficient. It's usually abbreviated, looks like a little P and a little O. And in the lossless case, we come up with a lossless case at this point. We would come out to, just doing it mathematically, 0.6. So now, if we wanted to know the actual coefficient of a reflection by calculation, what will we do? Well, we can take and say, well, let's see, our 0.631 times our 0.68, our calculated lossless, and that will come out to exactly 0.429. And we could use that, and if you want to swing the arc, then perhaps you'll get the precise, you know, precisely measurement if you want to be extremely critical. But that also, that basically refers to what we call election coefficient. I think, is this way of putting it, Dick, over?
Yes, I do. I agree with that stuff. Most people will take the reflection coefficient. When you do that math calculation that I described, take the absolute value of that complex number. They usually call it rho. As Mel mentioned, it looks like a small letter B, but it's a Greek letter. A bunch of these crazy numbers that keep happening over and over again, people have assigned Greek numbers to them. The fancy number that tells you that the division of diameter versus circumference of a circle, the 3.14159, that number keeps happening over and over again. Somebody gave it the name pi, P-I. It really is the Greek letter, out of the Greek letter, Greek alphabet called pi, and everybody has assigned it to that. Well, when it comes to the reflection coefficient on a transmission line, represented as an absolute value, you take the complex number of that division I talked about, and you take the square root of the sum of squares. You take the resistive component, you square it, you take the reactive component, you square it, you sum them together, you take the square root of that. That's how you take absolute value. That absolute value, people call it rho. Rho, you can then convert it into decibels of reflection by taking the log of it and multiplying by 20. That tells you decibels of round trip, the signal going down and coming back. Your reflection coefficient is X number of dB down. In this case, it's 3.38 dB. Take half of that number because you know the signal is going through twice, and you know the exact insertion loss of the cable. You could also take that complex number and leave it as a complex number. I'm talking about what you did with the division. Don't take the absolute value of it, but look at the resistive component, the reactive component. Take the reactive component divided by the resistive component. Take the inverse tangent of that, and it gives you a phase angle. So now you know the phase angle of what went down and what came back. And if you want to, you can convert that phase angle into electrical delay of the total cable round trip. And if the cable had, I didn't do the calculation, but if it came out 30 degrees total angle, and you know that, therefore, the signal went twice to go down there and come back, particularly if it's an open circuit, it would be 15 degrees down, in my example, 15 degrees back, and you know you had 15 degrees of electrical length of cable. So that division, the Z plus 50 ohms divided by Z minus 50 ohms, once you got the Z on your AEA measurement, it's giving you a lot of hidden information, telling you insertion loss, telling you electrical length of the cable. And by the way, when you have an open circuit on the end of a cable, the signal that reflects from the open circuit does not experience a phase shift at the open. Put in the back of your mind that if you're doing a short circuit test because you decided to make a short circuit stub, a short circuit, whenever a signal hits a short circuit, it experiences 180 degrees of phase shift at the short circuit as it reflects. You put all these little pieces of information together, and that AEA is telling you a lot of stuff all hidden together in that one little answer it gave you, 10 minus J10. It's got a lot of information if you know how to use it. And so by way of Mel showing you with the Smith chart, there's various ways you can draw lines and make measurements with your compass and go to the nomographs that are on the side of the Smith chart. They will give you insertion laws. They will give you VSWR. They'll give you phase angles. I'm showing you how to do it mathematically. A smart man will do both and compare the answers, and if they agree, he's got a lot more confidence. He knows what he's doing. He understands his system, and that knowledge is power, in my opinion. K2KEY, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Now, Roger, this is K2KEY. Yeah, that's why I did it both ways. The first, I did the math, did it out, worked it out mathematically, as I, but I stayed away from that initially and said, let's do it on a chart, because as they, I guess the old cliche of one picture's worth a thousand words, I purposely, you see, went to a very lossy case so that the illustration would come out, you know, very definite, so that you can actually see that a piece of cable like this you would never use it up here on 2 meters or 70 centimeters, that this would be really a piece of junk that's most likely found in the garbage pail. But it illustrates it that, like Dick was just saying, that you can do it both mathematically and then check your work visually, and you see visually, you know, that it's going to really make sense what you did mathematically. So basically, I always look for, you know, a two method to solve any problem, because then if they both more or less agree, well, you say, I guess I got the right answer. If one is completely out of the ballpark from the other, you say, I better go back to either my plotting it or my mathematics. But the plotting method is almost fairly straightforward, because it'd be pretty hard to not, you know, get 10 minus J10 not plotted correctly, and not finding also the electrical length mathematically and then plotting that. So you can work on both. I found you work both simultaneous many times, back and forth, and as you're working the math, you put it on the paper and back and forth. And as he said, it's a very interesting test we just did with a piece of cable. And it basically, you see that on the bottom of the chart, they start showing you things like voltage, reflection, coefficient scale on the bottom of the chart. And now you can understand a little bit more what that means, the bottom of the chart of the Smith chart, the nomograph. That's why I've been creeping into that in the last couple of weeks, the explanation of what that actually is indicating. So I guess this is basically a way of really determining really what is going on, and is a very helpful and handy tool when you are going to start looking at the cable, I believe, Dick, over.
Yeah, now, here's a beautiful example also of why a cable is a little bit non-common sense. A transmission line, we'd like to think it's like a piece of a water pipe. You put 10 pounds of pressure and 1 gallon per minute into the input end of a water pipe, and the water pipe is a little bit short. You get 9.9 pounds of pressure out of the far end, and the same 10 gallons per minute. So the water pipe is a fairly linear item. You'd like to believe that your transmission line behaves like a water pipe. And here, Mel put an open circuit at the far end of his piece of water pipe, his piece of transmission line, and what he measured on the input end is something very, very different. A transmission line is a kind of a impedance converter. If and only if you put a 50-ohm resistor at the far end, then everywhere along the transmission line, a 50-ohm transmission line, you'll measure 50 ohms. That's the match case. But the slightest amount of mismatch, a little bit of capacitive reactance or a little bit of inductive reactance, whether it be in series or in parallel, two slightly different conditions, is, from the transmission line's point of view, a disturbance. Any disturbance on that transmission line, meaning any deviation from 50 ohms resistance as a load, and it starts doing these crazy things. And so once you've got your known load, you know the resistive component, you know the reactive component, because you've measured the load directly with your AEA as opposed to through the transmission line, that information allows you to put a dot somewhere on the Smith chart. Once you put a dot on that Smith chart and you normalize it by dividing the real numbers by 50 ohms, that's how you put the dot. The transmission, the Smith chart is always normalized. That's crazy. You just take the resistive component, the reactive component, divide by 50 if it's a 50 ohm transmission line you're using. Or you divide by 70 if it's a 70 ohm transmission line. But in either case, you do the normalization to your particular transmission line that allows you to put that answer as a dot on the Smith chart. You then put your compass on the Smith chart with the sharp point in the center and the pencil on that dot, and you swing a circle, and now no matter clockwise on that circle you've just drawn, and all the possible impedances you're going to see on that transmission line are somewhere on that circle. And how many degrees of rotation you do on that circle is directly proportional to how many degrees of electrical length of transmission line you went down. And you'll notice that if you go all the way around one full circle on the Smith chart, that happens to equal 180 degrees, a half wave. That's a fancy way of saying if your transmission line is an exact number of half wavelengths long, no matter what crazy impedance you put on the end of it, on the input end of the transmission line, if it's low and loss, you'll measure the exact same impedance. If your transmission line has a whole lot of loss, it's not easy to draw it, but instead of drawing a circle, you're drawing a spiral that slowly spirals in toward the center. If you had very input in, you would see exactly 50 ohms. Unfortunately, not all the signal would get there. But so the Smith chart is telling you all the possible impedances you'll see with this crazy characteristic of transmission line. What you see is a function of where on the Smith chart, or where on the transmission line you make the measurement. And that's what the Smith chart is graphically telling you. You go to an equation that represents everything on that circle. I can give you that equation. It'll scare you. I happen to have it programmed into my calculator, and all I have to do with that program is someone tells me what is the load they're putting on the end of the line, how many ohms is the impedance of the transmission line, how many inches of line or feet of line it is, and I calculate the electrical length by dividing by the velocity factor. In other words, if I had a velocity factor of 0.5, I use that just because it's simple. That means if he told me there's 1 foot of transmission line really there measured with his ruler, and it happens to have a velocity factor of 0.5, meaning the signal travels down the cable half the speed of light, I know that that 1 foot of real length is 2 feet of electrical length. So I put into my little equation the real impedance he told me, that's on the end of the line. I calculate the real electrical length of the cable that he told me, or by velocity factor and length measured with a ruler. And the program goes through this crazy formula, and out comes the exact impedance I'm going to measure on the input end of the line, mathematically. I use that formula every other day in my place of business for predicting what's going to happen. To me, it's very handy. And periodically, I back it up with a Smith chart, like Mel is doing, and the answers better come out the same. Occasionally, I get an answer. I go out and figure out if it's going to work. I get something different. I go back to a Smith chart. Oh, I had the electrical length wrong. I had the phase velocity factor wrong, and so on. I forgot to plug in the velocity factor. But understanding transmission lines is a very valuable tool. Give you a crazy example of how this can happen. My output of my transistor for my first stage of my amplifier might have an output impedance of 10 ohms. I'll forget about the reactive component for a minute. And the input impedance of the next stage might be 5 ohms. And I'm going to run a small piece of coax cable, piece of semi-rigid cable, between the two. What length of cable should I run so that the conversion becomes correct? And there's ways of solving that with the Smith chart or with the mathematical equation. So by choosing the right length of line, you've done two-thirds of the impedance matching between the output of the first stage of the transistor amplifier and the second stage. So when we talk about transmission lines, most of us think about 30 feet or 100 feet of line that goes from the shack to the antenna. In many cases in a microwave circuit, the transmission line we're talking about is 1 inch or a quarter inch of cable that goes from the output of one stage of my transistorized amp into the input of the next stage. They're both transmission lines. The second case may be a piece of microstrip, or maybe a piece of small semi-rigid cable, but a quarter wavelength, a quarter inch of transmission line at a microwave frequency is very significant. If I'm operating at 10 gigs where the wavelength is 1 inch, a quarter inch of transmission line is going to be more than a quarter wavelength. And so it's an impedance matching device, and knowing how to calculate that can be very handy. If you're working for the final testing department that's aligning 10 gig amplifiers, and you've got a length of transmission line between the first stage and the second stage on the printed circuit board itself, and you're now doing some snowflaking, you're putting little chunks of copper on there to improve the impedance match, what are you really doing? And if you could make a rough estimate as to how many picofarad your little snowflake is adding at what position on the transmission line, you can now mathematically plot what you're doing, and you know why the gain went up, why the noise figure got better, and this random operation you're doing of snowflaking an amplifier on the final testing department suddenly starts making sense. Believe it or not, that's valuable information, particularly if you're going to design the next amplifier and you want to know the least expensive way of doing it. K2KUI, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Yep, Roger, K2RIW in the TechNet, K2KEY. I was going to say that I was going to next step that, but I think maybe we'll leave it for next week. I was going to really mention that as we get higher in frequency, discussion on transmission lines, and one of the uses of the Smith chart that was very valuable in the past, I don't know except for illustration purposes, would be like going above 300 megahertz and measuring by use of the slotted line method. Now, I figured maybe I could do an illustration by, you know, making a conventional impedance measuring by using the slotted line method and illustrating it on a Smith chart. So I'm going to try to make, I don't know if I should, I don't know, I'll see what the feedback is so far. And maybe I'm getting a little bit too far advanced, Dick, but you alluded to, you know, different methods, so I came to mind, you know, using the slotted line, if you want to touch on that, or I don't know, do you think we should leave it over?
Well, I see a lot of merit in discussing a slotted line for two reasons, for historic reasons and cost-effectiveness reasons. A modern-day network analyzer is a real breakthrough that started about 15 or 20 years ago, simply because some very smart engineer at Hewlett-Packard or a similar company, maybe it was Philips in Holland, or maybe it was, I can't think of the French company now. All of a sudden, I can't think of their name. Anyhow, there's a French company that makes some very good instrumentation. And so once these smart engineers 15 or 20 years ago discovered that with a little bit of care, they could measure exact phase angle of a very high frequency radio signal. Once you can measure phase angle, and once you can measure amplitude of signal at various points in a circuit, you put that together in a box, and it's called network analyzer. So with that new smarts, the first network analyzers went to a couple of gigahertz. Pretty soon they went to 20 gigs. Now you can buy network analyzers that work to 300 gigahertz. At 300 gigahertz, believe it or not, you can accurately measure phase and amplitude. It's a real breakthrough by modern-day standards. So that's the new technique, and the network analyzer does a lot of the math for you. Very handy instrument. That's the good news. You go to a flea market and you try to buy a network analyzer, you ain't going to find one. You go to eBay and other surplus markets, unless you've got $5,000 or $20,000 in your pocket, you ain't going to get a network analyzer. The AEA device that Mel's using is a poor man's equivalent. It's a darn good investment, but it's not quite lab quality network analyzer. Whereas we amateurs can definitely afford a slotted line. And if you're a little bit crafty with printed circuit boards and sheets of metal and connectors of radio and wireless engineering, real measurements of standing wave ratio and phase angles and electrical phase lengths and insertion losses, all of this jazz for the first 70 years of the radio environment, it was all measured on lecture wires, which is the early equivalent of slotted line. So slotted line has a lot of classic history. And properly used, it's a valuable instrument, and it's something we can buy inexpensively. You go to a flea market where they're selling a Hewlett-Packard 805, I think it is model number of slotted line, you may be able to get the thing for $30, so to speak. Beautiful piece of hardware. And you can homebrew that, and once you see the way it's built, and you go to just the word slotted line, and you start Googling that word, and you look at pictures of these things, you'll say, I can build that. I'm smart enough. There's no magic there. It's just a piece of flat plate outer coax cable with a round center conductor going down the center of it and a probe that slides across it with a ruler alongside of the probe so I know where it is. So you and I can build the slotted line. So therefore, if you want to go to the classic, inexpensive way of doing laboratory-grade measurements, a slotted line can do it. I don't think I would waste my time once I've got my hands on one of these AEAs, but the AEA is a few hundred dollars. If I'm a starting amateur radio operator and I've only got $20 in my pocket, maybe the slotted line is the right answer. And so the slotted line is a probe that is a minor capacitive pickup of the signal along your transmission line, and by sliding it, the little probe, back and forth on the slotted line, you can measure what happens here, an inch further downrange, a foot further downrange, and so on. And by looking at the change in amplitude or the change in phase of the signal picked up by that probe on the slotted line, look at the peak and the valley, that tells you exactly what your standing wave ratio is. The classic definition of standing wave ratio was measured on a slotted line. And we're using mass to convert it back to reflection coefficient and input impedance and so on. But slotted line was the classic. So there's a lot of merit in giving that information. Not only has it got a lot of history, but it's something we can all afford if you want to make laboratory-grade measurements without spending a lot of money. So I see some merit in it, Mel. KQKUI.
KQKUI with a comment.
Stand by, Mel. Go ahead, Eric.
Now, if you've got $600 in your pocket, you buy a brand new vector network analyzer. It was actually developed by Tapper. It's a fabulous instrument, and it's manufactured and marketed by Tentec. It's not a good packet, but boy, oh boy, it's a handy box to have. Go ahead, Nick.
Do you own one, or how did you find out about this, Eric?
Well, about 3 years ago, the guy who designed it put it in QEX and did a whole series of articles on it. Tapper had developed it and really put it together. The guys at Pentec loved it, and they said, we'll manufacture it for you. And yes, I have played with it, and I actually have one at home.
Fantastic. Okay, another good piece of information. So for $600, you can get a real network analyzer. What's the frequency range of that Tentec network analyzer, Eric? Go ahead.
It really only goes up to 50 megahertz, but you can use it at 2 meters. It works.
So it's rated from, I guess, 160 meters at least, up to 50 megacycles. I think you're saying you get reasonable accuracy out of it at 144 megacycles. And so you've had one for how long? You think it's a good selling product at Tentec? And by the way, the article in QEX, the Experimenters Exchange of ARRL, when that article came out, I think my guess is Tentec hadn't yet announced that it's going to be manufactured by them. So you found out about it. The QEX article might not have told me that. Back to you, Eric.
Roger, they were demonstrating it and selling it on the floor at Dayton this past year. So it was actually a real product at that point. Previously, it had been shown at the Tapper booth and Tapper shows, and they were still a little short on software, so it wasn't being distributed at that point. But the software is fabulous. Gives you Smith charts, gives you everything you want.
And by the way, you would never believe it, but these automatic antenna tuners that we can now buy from many of our high-end radios really is a network analyzer. What that automatic tuner is doing is it's measuring the reflected signal from your antenna, both in amplitude and phase angle. That tells the network, it's a poor man's network analyzer in the output of your so-called automatic antenna tuner. By measuring the reflection signal, amplitude, and phase, that tells the computer inside, the microprocessor, which way to move C1 and C2 of the Pi network, if it happens to be a Pi network. Therefore, it tells it exactly how to automatically tune and match your particular antenna. So there is the equivalent, the poor man's equivalent, of a network analyzer built into every one of your automatic antenna tuners. Other than that, it wouldn't know which way to go in order to adjust itself automatically. So there's a lot of merit of being able to measure amplitude and phase of an RF signal somewhere along a transmission line. I guess you get it, Mel. KQLIW on the TechNet.
Yeah, Roger. K2KY. Yeah, I saw that advertised, that 10 Tech instrument advertised. I didn't know that it was out on the market for sale. And yeah, it most likely would be a wonderful piece of equipment to have if you're working anywhere in the HF band up to 50 megahertz, or even the, like Eric said, extended possibly, works well up to 2 meters. What I was basically, you know, getting into with slotted line measurement is measuring things above 300 megahertz. And most of the instruments that, you know, you buy that's going to be reasonably priced, unless you find some, you know, the older, maybe some of them still fairly decent. But most of them, for amateur radio use, the conventional, you know, impedance measuring instrument, it can lack something above 300 megahertz. But if you went ahead and you do the slotted line method, you basically can get some very good measurements with it. And again, if you apply slotted line measurements and you work with the Smith chart, you can easily calculate low impedance from basically just from VSWR measurements and a voltage minimum along the line. This is what basically Dick is saying. So I was thinking that way to make an illustration of how you could do it literally for very, very little money, you know, and work, again, if you were working now, you know, talking about working on frequencies, say, from 300 megs and up, Dick, over.
Right now, I am looking at a slotted line made by the FXR company. It says type, am I? Type EIOC03A. This slotted line looks to me like it is made for waveguide, and I can tell that this is approximately V-band, 50 gigahertz waveguide. So I have in my hand a very miniature slotted line made for 50 gigahertz measurements. And 25 or so years ago, that was the right machine. It's got a dial indicator mounted at one end. As you move the little probe back and forth, the dial indicator measuring thousands of an inch. No, millimeters. How about that? It measures millimeters. So in millimeters and in centimeters, it measures the movement of your carriage, of your little probe, on this slotted line. And it's got a piece of waveguide that looks to me like around WR10, I think it is, waveguide. Very high frequency waveguide. So there were slotted lines that used to be used up to super high frequencies, and 20, 30 years ago when this instrument was popular, guarantee you, no one ever dreamed that at those frequencies you could even make amplitude measurements of any quality and phase measurements. I mean, measuring phase angle of even a 60 cycle signal sort of scares some people. And to make a phase angle measurement at RF frequencies at numbers like 50 and 100 gigahertz seems like it's just out of sight. Well, nowadays it's being done all the time with relatively expensive instrumentation, and there's value in doing that. So slotted lines and electrical wires, back in the very early days of spark gap radios, when people started first making measurements of why certain antennas work well and others do not, they wanted to know standing wave ratio and what's going on the open wire transmission line and so on. They use something called Letcher wire. It really is two parallel wires, very similar like the rest of their 600 ohm open wire system, with something like a neon bulb across the two, a measuring carriage that gets slides on those wires, and you slide it up and down the open wire transmission line system and recognize the spot where the light bulb lit up bright. You call that the peak, the place where it lit up very dim, you call that the valley. You measure the difference between the two, and that's how you first measure the wavelength. How did you know what frequency is the center frequency you're on with your spark gap transmitter? In the early days, that was measured with a Letcher wire system which is the early equivalent of a slotted line. It's a slotted line for open wire transmission lines. So in those days, that was the best you could do, and we've done a lot better since then. Whenever you look at any of these antique photographs of radio equipment that was used on ships and aircraft and in laboratories in, say, 1920 and 1930, you see a whole lot of wooden tables, wooden cabinets, great big coils of wire, big rotary spark gaps, high voltage transformers, and a very...
Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
As you can see, you in those photographs, you measured some... you look at those photographs, and it's hard to recognize those things. You go to any of the lectures by George Flanagan, W2KRM. He's one of the guys on Long Island who has studied the living daylights out of spark gap transmitters, rotary gap transmitters, arc transmitters, and spark transmitters. There's a difference between the two. And you go to any of these lectures, and he tends to give a lecture at Long Island University, Ham Radio University, every year. So this coming January, you go to the W2KRM lecture. You'll probably repeat it because it's a popular one. He gets a full house each time he does it. You will actually see in operation, hear in operation, a loud noise coming out of these machines that used to do transmitting. You'll smell the ozone. You'll be a real radio man, if you know what I mean. You go to one of the W2KRM lectures, and you'll see what spark gap radio and arc gap transmitting used to be like in, say, 1920, 1915, numbers like that. I mean, the SOS that came from the Titanic was on one of those transmitters, and he's got the first cousin of one of those in his personal possession. And so if you try to figure out what is the center frequency of your transmission, because you don't have a crystal on those things, it's all over the place, but depending on how you tune the coil and the antenna and the transmission line, there is a center frequency where the majority of your energy is in that arc transmitter or that spark transmitter. And George can give you a lot of information about that. And it used to be measured on the lecture wire system, which is the early equivalent of a slotted line, which is the very early equivalent of the modern-day network analyzer. So gives you some history of how we got here from there. And you ain't seen nothing yet. I don't know if anybody wants to give us any further comments, questions, or whatever of all of the above. Give me a call at us right now. If Paul's around, WS2N, I wish he would sign in. K2LIW on the TechNet.
And to Leo, Dick.
Rich recognized. Anyone else?
Now, K2KY, one final word.
Bell recognized. Anyone else? Okay, Rich, you got it first.
Okay, I missed some of that. I was upstairs. But on those rotary spark gap transmitters, they call them a rotary gap because what they had two electrodes with a spark. And in between the spark, it modulated, an early form of modulation. What they had was a turning disc with a motor, and the disc had notches in it, so it would make it would block and unblock the spark, and depending on the speed of the motor, you would get a higher, lower pitch whine out of the spark cap transmitter. And what I was told by old timers back in the 60s and 70s, when those guys were still, the older guys were still around and remembered spark, when they would sign off in, say, 73, what they would do is turn off the motor to the rotary gap. So as it was signing off, it would go da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. It would decrease in pitch, just a piece of trivia, Dick. Also, if anybody using open wire line, I use open wire line, and MFJ just came out with a very interesting product. About $100, called an MFJ 835 RF ammeter for balanced line. What it is it's a dual meter, you know, kind of like these dual SWR meters, but measures RF current on each side separately of the balanced line. And if they cross the center where there's a red line, you know that the lines are equal and opposite in balance. Quite a handy product. Board one works fine. Back to that at 2EO.
What does that thing cost, Rich?
I forget. It was like 70 or 80 bucks. It's in this month's QST. It's MFJ 835.
It's got a four position switch off, 0.3 amp, 1 amp, and 3 amps of RF current.
I bet your Mel would like to have a thing like that because he's been doing lots of experiments with his loop antenna and keeping track of the individual currents on the left wire and the right wire of his open wire line, and he finds that at certain ratios he gets a better transmitted signal. K2KEY, you've got it, Mel.
Roger, K2KEY. Yeah, I have surplus World War II RF amp meters. I still got a couple of them around, and with the thermocouples and that were built by Western Electric way back in World War II. They were fairly popular in those days, so coax cables and everything was just creeping in, but there were still calls for the old RF amp meters, you know, using the thermocouples. I was going to mention that I have a station here from 1910 that the gentleman here, I knew W was originally 2ML back in 1910. His name was Irving, and he operated that. He was the first ham station to operate at that time. They had a World's Fair called the World Exposition, and he set up a ham station. They're using this here, and most of the hams at the time were using four coils. And the spark app was a standard fancy spark app. The spark app must have cost more than the rest of the whole station, but you see the way this thing is made, with porcelain base and adjustable silver contacts and a whole business on it. And he took a picture, he had showed me, he took a picture of Marconi came to visit, and wrote to him standing with the picture of the station, and wrote on the picture he sent him, that from the first ham, good luck. So, most of the hams couldn't afford those fancy, what they used to call gap systems, rope gap spark transmitting systems. Many of them opted for the Ford coil system, Dick, over.
And I can see why. A Ford spark coil had sort of a buzzer arrangement on the primary and made you a fairly continuous spark on the secondary. And so the rate at which the buzzer operated created your tone, whereas the rotary spark gap, arc gap, whatever it's called, the rate of rotation and the number of poles to it created a tone. And I guess each guy, in some cases, had a characteristic tone frequency that could be recognized, as well as his characteristic fist, as they say, the way he sends Morse code. Each person has a little bit of personality to the way he sends Morse code. So among serious Morse code listeners and operators, most of the time you can recognize all your friends by the signature they use. In other words, the way they send Morse code. Each person's got a slight different way he sends the letters A, B, C, D, and so on, the spaces he puts in between. We've all got a little bit of characteristic. Only a very exacting machine like that paper tape machine they were used at the FCC headquarters in New York City. That one sent the exact code, and that one had no personality. Well, all the rest of us all have personality. Some of us put great big gaps between the letters and send the letters very fast. Some of us send the letters very slow with very small gaps, and they almost overlap each other. We've all got our characteristics. Just like our voice, most of the time you hear somebody talk on the air and you recognize that voice right away. And same thing over a telephone. We've all got our own signature. Anybody with any further questions or comments on what you've heard so far? K2R, give me the TechNet. Okay, if that being all, let's see, I think we've gone late enough tonight. We've made it to the magic hour of 11 o'clock, when the machine is going to go into the out-of-the-net mode. I'm going to say 73, you all. What you just listened to was the random ravings of Mel and I and other guys. This was TechNet number 1114 of the series that began in September of 1985. So here we are, what, 21 and a fraction years downrange. And the TechNet still exists. That's amazing to me. And to all those involved. Used to be called the Hip and Dick Show. But nowadays, it's the Mel and Dick Show. And we think we're going to be back next week. We think we got more little goodies to talk about. This wireless jazz, there's a lot to it. And we'll dig a little bit deeper. 73, you all. Bye-bye for now. Mel, for your final comment, K2RIW.
Just want to thank everybody again for the fine emails and the encouragement to continue going on with a little bit more of the expectation because of this jet. But I feel that the thank you that I get are well worth the effort. So we'll try to come up with another interesting illustration of a very great tool that around, as Dick said, from 1938 or 9, and show another application of it. So 73, so all have a great week. Take care, everybody, and try to stay well and enjoy the Thanksgiving holiday. This is K2KEY.
Bye-bye, you all. Try to be kind to each other. K2RW, TechNet Lamont, we're clear.